DBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. A search for two missing teens has led to discovery of seven bodies on a rural property in Henrietta, Oklahoma. They were thought to be with a 39-year-old man, and all three believed among the dead. Okmulgee County Sheriff Eddie Rice.
Our hearts go out to the families and friends, schoolmates, and everyone else, and it's just a tragedy in Okmulgee County.
They've closed parts of I-55 in south-central Illinois after a deadly dust storm made visibility near zero. Dozens of smashed cars and trucks being removed from the road. Major Ryan Sterick of Illinois State Police.
The initial crashes happened on the northbound side. Then there were also crashes on the southbound side at the same location.
At least six people killed, many others hurt. Getting together about raising the federal debt limit, President Biden and congressional leaders happens a week from tomorrow, just days after the Muslim fasting month of Ramadan. President Biden hosted an Eid celebration at the White House tonight with prominent Muslim leaders. This is ABC News. Gas prices are going down as we head toward the summer driving season.
For the second week in a row, the average price of regular unleaded has come down in the past week by 6 cents a gallon to a nationwide average of $3.60 a gallon, according to the Energy Department. The biggest drop seen along the Gulf Coast, down 11 cents in the last week to $3.15 a gallon. The most expensive gas remains in California at $4.66 a gallon on average for regular unleaded. Alex Stone, ABC News.
Jenny Craig closing locations nationwide.
Founded in 1983, the Jenny Craig Weight Loss Program is winding down its weight loss centers across the U.S. and in Canada and laying off workers. The once popular weight loss company says it's faced increased competition from diabetes drugs like Ozempic that are also helping people lose weight. The company has not said how many of its nearly 500 locations in North America will close or the exact number of layoffs, but a Jenny Craig spokesperson says the company is looking for a buyer while considering bankruptcy. Derek Dennis, ABC News.
Andy Field, ABC News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios. Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. One in three Wisconsin families tell the United Way they're struggling to pay for basic necessities. The report helps identify people who are above the poverty line but don't make enough money to cover the cost of living. State lawmakers are putting the finishing touches on an historic reworking of Wisconsin's shared revenue system. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss says Republicans collaborated with Democrats and consulted Governor Evers.
I think this is an area that Wisconsinites should be proud of. People sat down at the table. We didn't always agree, but people of goodwill hopefully found a good conclusion at the end.
Voss was on WISN's Upfront program Sunday. 20% of the state sales tax would go to local governments, increasing shared revenue by 10%. In sports, the Packers are busy signing undrafted free agents now that the NFL college draft is over. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
He's the grave digger, Gilbert Brown.
Where can you go where it's always a standing room only? You ain't gonna find that in Chicago.
It's never personal, only politics.
You ain't gonna find that in Minnesota, standing room only, because you can go to the gumball machine, stick a quarter in there, I'll come pick it.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
That's the way it is, man. We love football, fans love us.
Weekdays 4 to 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
VA has a new life insurance program for veterans with service-connected disabilities called Veterans Affairs Life Insurance, or VA Life. VA Life benefits include up to $40,000 in coverage, no medical questions to enroll, and no time limit to apply if you are age 80 or under. Veterans can apply, receive an instant decision, and manage their policy online. Learn more about VA Life or apply online by visiting va.gov/life-insurance. Protect those who matter most with VA Life Insurance.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now. And AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving.
Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
You were supposed to get a colon cancer screening, but stuff came up.
We did have to pick up the twins from practice.
But on the way, we hit a giant pothole.
Over
on
if you are 45 and older, don't let but stuff get in the way of your screening. Visit the Colorectal Cancer Alliance at ccalliance.org.
But then...
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Your hometown radio, refreshed. Keeping you informed, entertained, and connected on the Civic Media Network, civicmedia.us. Looking for more local programming? Check out our website, civicmedia.us, to see our entire lineup.
Join us daily at therickssmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it's being reported we're on the brink of a writer's strike. Gonna happen, I guess. Nope, I guess the time is ticking. And this is, this is one of those moments where I go, I remember the writer's strike that brought us the reality TV shows that they used to try and break the unions. This is, again, why we need to be supporting these folks. And it's mind-blowing in an industry that's making such enormous wealth that, again, they don't want to share. But here to share some thoughts on what's going on and what we should know as this happens, I've asked Michael Sonato to come talk with us. Michael's a labor reporter at The Guardian. Michael, thanks for taking time for us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So what's going on? What do we know at this point about the writers? And is there going to be a strike? Is that a for sure thing? Do we know yet? Where are we?
The deadline is midnight tonight Pacific time. So we'll know in a few hours if they reach a last minute deal or not. So I mean, basically from what we've seen, they're still kind of far apart. The movie companies don't seem to want to offer the gains that the union and workers are asking for. And that's, what's at stake here is with everything that's transitioned to streaming over the past few years, pay for writers in Hollywood for TV and film has, declined, stagnated, and the studios have made all these different tactics with short order, shorter seasons on shows, hiring fewer writers, expecting one or two writers to do the work of numerous people, and coming up with loopholes to pay more writers than what we've seen the past decade, getting the basic minimum from the contract, so they're not getting paid based on seniority or experience. The common misconception is that if you're writing in Hollywood, you made it, you're successful. So there's a story that came out that showed The Bear on FX. One of the writers for that had to take out a loan to get his tux to go to the Emmys, and just had no money, and that's kind of what the negotiations and fight are about. It's not a sustainable career for people who are seeing success in getting successful TV shows and things like that, and what we've seen from these big media companies, their executives are getting huge salaries. They're making tons of profit. And they're putting a ton of money in aggressively expanding and merging all these different media companies and all these different services, but they don't want to pay for the people who are creating the content. There's no shows if no one's there to write it and guide it along. And One of the funny stories from the last writer's strike that I read in the past few days is Daniel Craig was talking about how during the 2007-2008 writer's strike, the last time writers went on strike, it kind of ruined Quantum of Solace because he was stuck doing the rewrites and stuff for that because they got the script 2 days before they went on strike. And he said, he swore and said it messed up the production, but he's like, I'm not a writer. This was a mess. And it's, you know, kind of funny getting that kind of that back scenes view on, you know, how important these people are and the kind of work they're doing to guide along, yep. You know, the things we watch every day.
It's important to be able to deliver the line, but you got to have a line to deliver.
Yeah.
No, I hope this, again, as I hope for all strikes, I hope this is short. I hope this does what it's supposed to do and gets people, it's that jolt that gets people back to the table and negotiating in good faith. And I hope these writers get what they earn, because that's ultimately what this is about, the wealth that their labor creates being compensated at a fair rate. Now, I talked to my friend Tom Arnold, who just said the other day, if there's a writer's strike, he's coming back on the show. So we're going to get Tom, if this happens, back to support these workers. I got to get your thoughts on a story you wrote the other day that caught my attention. It was the main reason I reached out. Because you know, one of the frames I get from people all the time, Michael, is that, you know, we don't need those unions anymore, you know, because we're so much better than this, and we don't do the kind of menial manual labor that unions are supposed to be known for. And yet you got a piece out now that you've got, you know, doctors who are organizing at an incredible pace. You know, tell me how's this going, and what are we looking at down the road as these residents and these doctors are going, hey, we do need some protections. We do need some say.
It, you know, a lot of it's coming out of, you know, these resident doctors. So once you get out of med school, you typically you get placed into residency for, you know, 3 years until you take your boards, and then, you know, you're making the, you know, typical doctor salary, or that's how it's supposed to go. But in those 3 years, you're working at, you know, a hospital, a teaching hospital. And so, you know, during the pandemic, hospitals kind of, you know, relied and threw those workers really, you know, to the wolves, is, you know, so to speak. They were meant to deal with all the surges and all the different difficulties and challenges with that. And they obviously didn't have a say in how that was enacted or you know, instituted in their hospitals. So basically they were taken advantage of and utilized as hospital management, which, you know, were either safe in their offices or at home, you know, making those kinds of decisions. So it kind of, I think, exposed the disconnect that a lot of these big hospitals have, where the rules, the working conditions that these workers are working under are dictated by people that don't know what's going on, or, you know, don't deal with the patients, don't see what the issues are. And you know, almost all the doctors I spoke to were said, we're the first ones that the patients see when we come out. We know what their issues are, and, you know, we have our own issues. And, you know, pay is another issue, because a lot of these hospitals are in big cities. So, you know, they might be making $80,000-$90,000 for their residency, but if they have to live close to the hospital because they're working 80 hours a week, then they're paying, you know, top rents in some of the biggest cities. Like I spoke with, you know, residents at Stanford and, you know, UPenn, and in Boston, you know, those places are expensive. And yeah, they're facing, unfortunately, they're facing the typical union busting that you see from employers. Some of it was pretty comical. I linked There was a PowerPoint presentation, an anti-union one. They had some of the typical arguments. All of it's complaining, saying we want a direct relationship. We do better with the direct relationship. Unions will be bad for you, type of thing. The scare tactics. It might get worse. If it was worse, you wouldn't be opposing it. So it's just ridiculous. And optimistic about it is a lot of these union elections, even one that I talked about, George Washington University, they won their union election by a landslide. I think maybe a few hundred voted for it, and I think 20 or so voted against it. So, I think that shows, you know, not only the what is going on in this country in terms of people kind of waking up to see, like, okay, work is kind of brutal. What can we do to improve this aside from, you know, quitting? And, you know, we're seeing Starbucks workers stand up against, you know, a billionaire who has shown clear disdain for his workers and the constant union busting and labor law violations that company is engaged in. I think it was a really interesting story just because, you know, it's not something you hear about. It's not something you're going to see on the news, or if people are talking about unions, you know, like you said, people like to claim that we don't need them anymore, that are outdated, which is nonsensical. But, you know, this clearly shows that, you know, workers, and especially these people are working alongside nurses, where, you know, I think they have a unionization rate of around like 23-24% right now, which is, you know, not, it could be higher, but it's more than double the unionization rate in the U.S. right now. So,
it's interesting though, you know, because, you know, no matter what you do, whether you're a doctor or you're working in a warehouse, it does come back to wages, hours, conditions. And that's what they're fighting for. But, you know, it's interesting to me that as these doctors are coming around to, you know, hey, we have to have representation. We want to make our conditions better. I look at what some states across this country are doing in rolling back child labor protections. And you go, there's just this imbalance of sanity that's going on. And you know, while, again, you've got these doctors who've come to the reality that individually they can't make their lives better, they've got to do it collectively, you've got these states going, hey, you know, we need to fill the void of cheap labor, and what better way to get that cheap labor than get the kids into the workforce? You know, Newt Gingrich joked about firing the union janitor and letting the kid in the school clean the bathroom. This is where they're moving towards, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really, it's ridiculous how these laws kind of like either have secretly without much attention, or, you know, what happened in Iowa, it's not passed yet, but passing the Senate, you know, one of the big issues were the Republicans pushing that legislation refused to speak about it during the Senate hearings. And that was because they didn't want to say anything that would be used against them in the Iowa State Supreme Court overturning the legislation. So, you know, I've cited some of the arguments and claims for that proponents have had, and it's all industries like, oh, this is going to expand opportunities. But this is not something that is an organic or grassroots thing. No 14-year-old is like, I got to work at these jobs. No one is advocating for that. It's industries, it's, you know, wealthy employers, wealthy business groups and conservative think tanks that have come up with ways to basically draft state legislation and, you know, sneakily, you know, pass it. And it's, you know, it's an all-out attack. You know, it's popping up in, you know, numerous states. There's been a few bills proposed at the federal level, but I don't think, you know, and it's scary because we do have a Republican Congress now where you know, if they wanted to, I don't know if they are willing to put that up for a public debate, because obviously it wouldn't go well for them, because I think the average American can clearly see why we have child labor protections to begin with. The fact that these child labor violations have been rising over the past few years, we've had some big investigations come out that are just, harrowing and kind of ridiculous and reminiscent of, like, oh, this is something that, you know, you've seen those photos 100 years ago of, like, little kid, the little kid chimney sweeper, or like little kids in the factory. It's like they're pushing towards, you know, slowly ticking towards back that way.
Oh, come on, Michael, you're just being hyperbolic. That's not what the bill says. We don't want kids on the kill floor of the meatpacking plants. We just want them on the kill floor of the meatpacking plants to clean the machinery. They're not actually killing anything. And we're going to give, you know, companies a liability shield if we partner up with the schools, and we'll call it an apprenticeship program of doing cheap labor, you know, because the kids want this. The kids are pining for some responsibility, Michael.
Yeah, that is really the arguments they're making. And what the concerns and dangers about this is if you allow that kind of leeway, then what's next? And they could say, oh, they're already cleaning the plants, why can't they work on the meat assembly line? And things like that. And, you know, we know based on the worker injury and worker fatality data that younger workers have higher rates and risks of injuries. Looked through the OSHA, you know, fatality website, and I've, you know, in the article, I spoke with the mother who, you know, the kid was 18 and his father was still at the job site, but it's, you know, the logging industry is one of the most dangerous industries still in the country. They're repeatedly, year after year, the most workplace, the highest fatality rates of any, you know, industry in the country. And she spoke, you know, she's very eloquent about why this is a bad idea, why they're opposing it, and you know, pointing out that the senator who drafted this bill, a senator from Idaho, dismissed it. He had nothing constructive to say. He's like, oh, that's too bad, but we want to still do this anyways, because you see that they tout that who's supporting this bill. Oh, it's the logging, the industry association and the industry, and that's who they want. They want the cheap labor.
We're heading back 100 years. So if all the people who tell me that we don't need unions anymore because we just needed them 100 years ago, well, we're about to recreate 100 years ago. Michael, I appreciate you taking some time. I hope folks will check out the incredible reporting you do. TheGuardian.com is the website. We'll get links out on social media to Michael's articles. And I appreciate the time, man. Great stuff.
Thanks, Rick. Always a pleasure.
I got to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, another gun story. And look, there's always a bunch of gun stories. But this one caught my attention. Evidently, a high school kid, or a college kid, I'm sorry, 18-year-old college kid he was. Or is, he didn't die, but, you know, evidently, 18-year-old baseball player, plays for the University of Texas, Texas A&M University at Texarkana, sitting in the bullpen, you know, minding his business, waiting for his chance to go out and pitch and, you know, watching the game, shot in the chest. Just sitting in the bullpen, you know, and I guess it's Texas, bullets flying everywhere, why not? And the spokesperson for the Texarkana, Texas Police Department, his name's Sean Vaughn. I don't know who does that to a child, but Sean Vaughn said that, well, you know, it's incredibly bad luck. Just bad place. You know, bad, basically, yeah, you know, it happens. Bad place, wrong time. Sorry. Now, this is the same area where you know, this area, I guess, this Spring Lake Park was filled with, you know, hundreds of Boy Scouts doing their, you know, had planned their camp-a-rama or scout-a-rama. Sadly, that had to be canceled because of shootings. And it's one of these things where, you know, what happened? Oh, well, just, you know, people shooting. It's people, you know, cars, you know, firing, driving by, shooting, you know, who knows? And, you know, my mind goes into this place of, you know, okay, when do we get the safety stuff? When does this, you know, because Texas has got more guns than anybody. I thought Texas with the more guns was going to be a safe place. And yet you look at the rising death rates in Texas. If that idea of, you know, more guns, less laws, more people, you know, with their right to guns, would make us safer. Texas should be the safest place on earth, right? If that logic goes to play, but evidently not, because you can't sit in the bullpen without worrying about getting shot nowadays. And you look at some of the statistics, you know, the death rate of the firearm death over the last, you know, 20 years has gone from right around 2,000 in 1999 up to 3,400 in 2017. I mean, we're talking a huge jump. So it's going up because we're saying no, more people need more guns. And this idea of I'm going to stand my ground, and it's grabbing on to people. For instance, this his name's Chris. He's a weather nut from Texas. His handle is iWeatherNet. He tweeted out that a child just rang my doorbell. Folks, you do not ring doorbells in 2023. My six was loaded. Keep your kids away. And someone said, hey, you know, what's wrong with you? Are you willing to shoot someone just because you had the audacity to ring your doorbell? And he responded to this person by going, I'm not blanking around. He used the F word. I can't say that. And then after some blowback, he then goes into a much more in-depth rant about how it's a bad idea to let your kids go out and ring doorbells. You know, this isn't 1972, he says. you know, that this person was looking for their kitten. He says, I'm so impatient. I feel bad because I wanted her to... I warned her that I might pull her hair if they rang my doorbell again. She started crying. And you go, what is wrong with this person? Who a kid comes to the door going, I'm looking for my cat, and he's going to pull her hair. If you ring the doorbell, he's going to shoot you. What is wrong? What is wrong with people? And he finishes it up by saying, please teach your kids to stay away from doorbells. Is that the nation we want? Because on the other side of the door is some curmudgeon, some grumpy old man with a gun who's just fetishizing shooting somebody on the other side. Is this who we've become? My goodness. But we're going to make laws to where when he does shoot somebody, that stand your ground laws might be a defense. Because they're saying that there might be a defense for the guy who shot the kid through the door. He was standing his ground. He was protecting his castle. I don't know what from what. But does this not bother you? And how much worse does it get? And when do I have to start shooting somebody just because you looked at me funny? Or the other way around? We need some sanity. We need some leadership. Sadly, not a lot of either. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1886. That was the day that workers throughout the United States walked off their jobs in a coordinated, planned effort and demanded the 8-hour day. What made this strike truly revolutionary was that the workers were not asking for reduced pay for reduced hours. They wanted their pay level to stay the same. Chicago labor activist Alan Parsons explained this that March for the Chicago Daily News, saying, quote, "The movement to reduce the work hours is intended by its projectors to give a peaceful solution to the difficulties between capitalists and laborers. I have always held that there were two ways to settle this trouble, either by peaceable means or violent methods. Reduced hours, or 8 hours, is the peace offering. Fewer hours mean more pay. Reduced hours is only the measure of economic reform, which consults the interests of the laborers as producers, which can only be acquired by possessing and consuming a larger share of their own project. This would diminish the profits of the exploiters. That first day of May, tens of thousands took to the streets in Chicago, and an estimated 300,000 protested across the nation, marching for the 8-hour day. The strike met with early success, but then 3 days later, an unknown person threw a bomb at a workers' rally in Chicago's Haymarket Square. The government crackdown against the 8-hour movement was quick and harsh. 8 men stood trial in Chicago for the bombing. 4 were martyred despite a lack of evidence tying them to the bomb. But the idea of the 8-hour day was not so easily crushed. It spread not only in the United States, but across the world. Now, more than a century later, May Day, this day is the International Workers' Holiday. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
When public officials get themselves mired in the muck of corruption, they can always count on Senator Ted Cruz to issue a moral judgment. If the offender is a Democrat, he pronounces the corruption inexcusably grotesque. If it's a Republican, he wails that the offender is the victim. For example, Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas was recently caught, yet again, butt deep in judicial immorality, taking hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of freebies from a Texas real estate baron who has both a partisan and corporate interest in Thomas's court rulings. So, Cruz to the rescue. No judicial impropriety here, he squawks, for this is nothing but a diabolical plot by Democrats to smear poor Clarence. But Thomas is busy smearing himself, so Dems can just take the advice of Woodrow Wilson. Never attempt to murder a man who's committing suicide. From the start of his court tenure, Thomas has been a shameless seeker of personal gain, tucking untold sums from untold sources in the inner pockets of his judicial robes. He learned to hide his corruption in 2004 when he actually reported taking pricey gifts from a special interest, which got him widely condemned. So he reformed. No, he didn't quit taking gimmies, he just quit disclosing them. Thomas is a supreme grifter, but sadly he's not alone. Many recent justices have fallen from the pedestal of judicial integrity, cozying up to the moneyed interests. Gifts aside, we now have a hyper-partisan right-wing Republican majority taking their judicial opinions from those same interests, turning America's unelected third branch of government into an autocratic, plutocratic political agency. Then they wonder why their public approval rating and legitimacy are in the ditch. This is Jim Hightower saying, since they won't reform themselves, we must do it for them. To help, go to fixthecourt.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, International Workers' Day, May Day, and I look at what's going on in France, and you know, you've got the union there saying, what, two and a half million people out in the streets, you know, protesting the rise of the retirement age from 62 to 64, which nobody's thrilled with. But as one person reminded me, this isn't just about the rise in retirement age. This isn't about that. It's about democracy. It's about, you know, people were never really consulted on. This was never put out to the people to say, look, is this what this was done unilaterally. And this is why I think a lot of people are even more upset than the fact that they're screwing with their pension system and not taxing the very wealthy and all that other stuff. So on this International Workers' Day, you know, a big outpouring. I'm here to share some thoughts on what's going on there and why it's important, why we should be paying attention. I've asked John Logan to come talk with us. John's a professor and the director of labor and employment studies at San Francisco State University. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, Rick. Glad to be on.
So, you couple million people out in the streets in France. It actually did make it into U.S. news a little bit, a little blurb on page 7 of the newspaper, but it got a little something.
Yeah, no, it's a remarkable demonstration. And as you know, this has been going on for weeks and weeks and weeks. They've had hundreds of thousands and millions of people, not just in Paris. I mean, huge demonstration today in Paris, but in, you know, cities all over the country. And as you said, I mean, you know, the immediate issue is the raising of the retirement age from 62 to 64. The original proposal was 65. They lowered it to 64. And again, as you said, you know, Macron, the president of France, has been determined to push this through. He says there's no alternative. People are living longer. You know, demographic changes. We need, you know, the projections are that the pension system will lose $10 billion a year for the next 10 years. And so we have to do this. And, you know, people in the unions, people on the left say, no, there are alternatives. The amount of money to keep the pension system as it is, to keep it solvent, is actually not that great. And as you said, by having a fairer tax system, for having the very rich in France to pay their fair share, it could easily be dealt with in a number of different ways. But also, as you said, I mean, there's the issue of how this has come about. And, you know, Macron is actually in a very weak position. You know, this is a very unpopular reform with the general public who sympathize with the protesters. And even politically, he's had to invoke special constitutional measures in order to get this through, you know, not taking it before the lower legislative body, the assembly, because it wasn't certain that he would have sufficient support to get it through there. So it is law now, but there have been previous cases. You know, the protesters, the unions have said they're not backing down. They're going to continue to protest, huge protests today. They're going to continue to escalate. And there have been previous examples of French governments backing down after the fact. Once, you know, France as a whole, and I know this sounds like a little bit of a cliche, but it is actually very, very true. You know, the French elite, the political elite, the economics elite, are very much still haunted by the specter of May 1968 in Paris, when workers and students got together and, you know, nearly caused a revolution. And major concessions were made to workers in the wake of those protests in May 1968. And so every time they see protests like this, and the French are very good at getting hundreds of thousands and sometimes millions of people out in the street to protest, that is at the back of their mind. They said, oh, you know, could this really get out of control? Yep. Are we actually facing a situation where, you know, we are, our positions are threatened by this? So, you know, we don't know how it's going to end yet. Public opinion at the moment is on the side of the demonstrators. And, you know, as I said to you, you know, before we came on air, you know, French unions and French workers have built up this sort of fairly well-developed and, welfare system that they think of as being, you know, basic rights. And, you know, now they're being told, no, we're changing the rules of the game. And again, you know, it's a very broad generalization, but, you know, when people come to think of certain things as rights and then you take them away, you know, there's nothing that sort of energizes people more. I mean, you know, there are certain things, of course, that Americans think of as basic rights, but, you know, if only we could think, you know, get American unions and American workers to think of, like, you know, retiring with dignity at age 62 as a fundamental right, and, you know, to be able to mobilize people in terms of those. And it's, you know, it's an interesting thing. You know, people look at union membership in France, which is officially very, very low. I mean, you know, at U.S. levels, and they think, wow, you know, only 5-6% of French workers are members of unions. But on the other hand, over 90% of French workers are covered by collective agreements because of the system of sectoral bargaining. But, you know, both of those figures, a little bit misleading. I won't go into it in great detail. But, you know, the 5-6% actually really refers to union activists rather than union members. I mean, even the word, you know, means something different from, you know, what we would understand as the meaning of a union member. So, you know, again, you know, imagine the US or, you know, many other countries had 5-6% of workers were activists within their unions. I mean, that's, you know, very significant, you know, base in which you can mobilize. The 90% too sounds wonderful, 90% plus people covered by collective agreements. And it is good, but it's not as good as it sounds. I mean, so often these agreements only really establish basic minimum conditions. And, you know, what really happens, you know, depends on the strength of organization at the company and at the workshop level, at the workplace level. So, you know, it's a sort of mixed situation, but, you know, certainly, as I say, the, you know, the French, you know, they introduced the 35-hour work week in the 90s, 98, and then again in 2000. And, you know, there've been repeatedly been efforts to weaken that. And again, it's not as good as, you know, the idea that, you know, people in France work far, far less than, you know, people in other European countries is a little bit misleading. But they do have that legislation, huge demonstrations against it. Same again, you know, when the attempt to introduce sort of neoliberal labor market reforms to make it easier for companies to hire and fire workers. I mean, one thing about France and, you know, other countries in Europe too, is once you are hired as a full-time employee, it's actually quite difficult to fire you. You know, so when you get these big transnational corporations, manufacturing corporations, tech corporations, whoever it might be, and, you know, they're making global layoffs, you know, they're, you know, getting rid of, you know, tens of thousands of workers sometimes, it's far easier for them to lay off workers in the United States than it is in France, you know, and yeah. So that's usually what happens. So they will fight to the death to maintain, you know, certain things that they've come to think of as, you know, basic rights and, you know, being treated with sort of basic human dignity. And, you know, it's a combination of the unions are very heavily involved in these demonstrations, socialists, people on the left, but it's actually quite a broad spectrum of French society now that's participating. You know, some of the people who are known as the Yellow Vest who participated in these very widespread protests against the rising cost of fuel a few years ago, and, you know, sometimes are thought as being part of the populist right. But, you know, they too, you know, have joined with the protests. And so there's a great deal of real anger towards the Macron government. And as I said, his position is actually quite weak. So we don't know how this is going to play out yet. Yeah.
No, it's interesting for me because you bring up the Yellow Vest folks that are you know, I view as the right. And of course, you know the labor unions there are more of the left, and that there are common commonalities there. And I keep saying the same thing about here in the U.S. The way that we reunite this country is in the workplace. We bring them back together, fight for better wages, hours, conditions, and win things. You know, you said 1968 was, you know, the year that they remember. Yeah. That's, there are a lot of people alive who still remember that and can pass that along. Right. And hey, we fought for things. We made things better. We aren't going to lose this. We got to get out the pitchforks. We're going to get the pitchforks out. Yeah. And we don't have that here in this country. We've been sold this idea of, you know, hooray for me and the heck with everyone else. Greed is good. The one who dies with the most toys wins. And that doesn't lead to hundreds of thousands of people taking to the streets to fight against raising the retirement age. Last I saw, they want to take it into the 70s. It doesn't equate to the same things.
No, absolutely not. And as you said, I mean, Americans, you know, typically work longer, are dying earlier. And, you know, this is the thing in France, too. I mean, like, one of the original proposals, I mean, I think it's actually still in the law that went into effect, is that you have to work 43 years in order to qualify for a full state pension. I mean, the full state pension is very generous compared with the US. I mean, this is another thing. It's not only that they get to retire earlier, but as I said before, they get to retire with dignity. I mean, the pension is, you know, far, far better than, you know, what most American workers, who have got to look forward to after retirement, particularly, you know, non-union workers in the private sector in the U.S. You know, many are facing, you know, very, very precarious economic position in their old age. So
no, they're screwed, John. You can say it. The working class of this country, moving forward, is screwed come retirement age, because there are no defined benefit pensions for people, hardly anymore. And those defined contributions they told us were going to make us all millionaires. The average is about $18,000 per person, not a luxurious retirement. So people aren't going to be able to retire. And we're told that that's normal on a certain screwy level.
Yeah. And in France, you know, I mean, they point out, which we know, but, you know, there it becomes a reason for people to get out in the streets and to protest and to demonstrate and to say, no, you're not going to do this. They know that, you know, the people who would be most adversely affected by these changes are people, you know, who have been working in manual labor and blue collar jobs, who entered the workforce earlier, who have been working for longer, and who, you know,
their bodies are shot.
Exactly. Expect less, you know, years in retirement, even as it is.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it does seem sort of in that perspective, you know, fundamentally unfair. And, you know, I think that, I mean, if, you know, we desperately need, you know, someone, you know, whether it be Joe Biden or someone else, to adopt a more stronger economic populist message and said, as you said, you know, the working class in this country is, you know, already, you know, we have, like, you know, these sort of vision of the future of work presented by, you know, the Harshults and Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, that is based basically on low wages, expendable workers, algorithmic management, and no independent voice. And, you know, it's going to be a complete disaster for most American workers, you know, and we're really at the point where this is a national crisis. And, you know, we need to have demonstrations on the scale that we see in Paris and other cities.
We need all of that. But the only thing we see people organizing around is who's going to what bathroom. It's insane to me. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show with John Logan. John's a professor and director of labor and employment studies at San Francisco State University. I want to change gears real quick because I only got a couple minutes left. You know, the Ben and Jerry's organizing campaign. I talked about this the other day. You know, of course, Ben and Jerry's, of course, Ben and Jerry's would say, yes, come in and organize our workforce.
Yeah.
This is what I would hope the model of the future could be.
Yes.
Tell me, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think there's two striking things. I mean, as I said to you, you know, before we started, I was up, actually up in Burlington and met with members of the organizing committee there, and you know, with the lead organizer, Becca Mendelssohn, who's like this sort of fantastic University of Vermont senior. And, you know, it has the same feel as a lot of these other organizing campaigns that we're seeing, you know, at Starbucks, at REI, at Apple, at Trader Joe's. It's sort of young people who are really powerfully attracted to the idea of organizing their own workplace. They're, you know, they don't really know, you know, most of them have had no previous involvement with labor activism. I mean, they're young people who have worked non-union jobs and low-wage jobs in the service sector. But there's something very powerful and very appealing about the idea of organizing your own workplace. They're really driven to do it. And, you know, in that respect, that is very, very hopeful, I think, you know, because, you know, is, you know, for them, organizing is not something that's done to you. It's something you do yourself. You know, they don't know much about the labor establishment, probably don't even care that much, but, you know, they really want to organize their own workplace. And, you know, it's just absolutely terrific. You know, it's so refreshing to me. Second thing is that, you know, Ben & Jerry's is the, which, as you said, is owned by Unilever, one of the biggest, you know, food and cosmetics companies in the world. But they have decided to embrace the so-called fair election principles, which were, you know, developed by veteran labor organizer Richard Bensinger and also promoted during the Starbucks Workers United. You know, Starbucks, of course, did not adopt the fair election principles, went down a different route, you know, firing dozens
the of union buster of workers.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, so even although this is just starting at the flagship store, 40 workers, 39 of whom immediately signed union cards in Burlington, Vermont, it's the first major corporation to sign the fair election principles and say, yes, you know, we workers deserve a fair choice. You know, we will not bully them. We will not intimidate them. We will not play legal games to prevent them from bargaining if they decide to form a union. And finally, the other thing I'll say is, you know, the important thing about campaigns like Ben & Jerry's, again, it's like Starbucks, it's like Trader Joe's, it's like Apple, you know, these are iconic companies. What happens there makes for great media coverage, great social media coverage. This is how young people find out about these campaigns, how they're excited about them, how they're inspired by them. So, you know, already we've had, like, you know, really good stories, you know, in Washington Post, Lauren Gurley, you know, Noam Scheiber in the New York Times, Josh Idelson in Bloomberg, and on and on and on. You know, Ben & Jerry's, everyone knows Ben & Jerry's. You know, you have like a very direct relationship with companies like this. So, you know, even though the number of workers at the moment is quite small, I think it has the potential to spread. In fact, it immediately spread to a cafe, which has four outlets in the Burlington area called Black Cap, which is about two stores down from Ben & Jerry's. You know, they heard, oh, they're organizing at Ben & Jerry's. We should do the same thing.
That's contagious.
Here. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, this is the sort of dynamic, you know, if we are going to have a sort of meaningful union revival in this country, I think it is going to depend on a lot of this sort of self-organizing dynamic. And I think a lot of it is going to be led by young people who, as I said, are strongly attracted to the idea of organizing their own workplace. So it's just, you know, it's a fabulous campaign. You know, we'll see how it goes. Hopefully it will spread. You know, they have a union called Scoopers United. So, you know, there's no reason why that should just be Ben & Jerry's. You know, that could be like, you know, anyone. You know.
I'm all in favor of it. Look, if you're going to if you're gonna make my Cherry Garcia with union labor, I am all in favor of it. Chunky Monkey as well. I'm looking forward to it. But, John, I appreciate the time and the thoughts. Great stuff. Look forward to having you back again real soon.
Nice to be on, Rick. Thank you.
Thanks so much. No, look, I'm thrilled at some of these campaigns. And as I've said before, the young people are going to be the future. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history,
The year was 1886. This was the day that began events in Chicago that would make May 1st the most important day on the calendar for the labor movement across the world. The sun shone brightly in Chicago that day. 90,000 workers took to the streets to protest for the 8-hour day. Nearly half of them were on strike, and the rest were marching in support of the demands of working people. Many of the marches had a festive air, with music playing and banners waving. Across the country, estimates of as many as 500,000 workers participated in the walkout. Labor was on the march. But then, just 3 days later, striking workers were gunned down by police at Chicago's McCormick Reaper plant. The next night, police marched on a workers' rally that was about to wrap up at Haymarket Square. An unknown person threw a bomb into the police ranks, and the police responded by shooting wildly, striking protesters and their own men. The police crackdown against union leaders and suspected radicals was fierce. 8 men were rounded up and blamed for the crime. Despite a lack of any evidence tying them to the bombing, 4 of the accused were hung. The Haymarket Martyrs became international heroes of the labor movement. On May 1st, 1890, labor leaders across Europe and the United States declared May Day the workers' holiday. In cities across the world, tens of thousands marched for the 8-hour day. Now, more than 125 years after the fateful week in Chicago, May Day remains International Labor Day. Today, a monument stands at the site of Haymarket, and each year, labor leaders from across the world travel to Chicago to visit and commemorate the site.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So for our Minnesota listeners, evidently a lawmaker, Cal is his name, Cal Barr, Senator Calvin, Cal. Evidently, there was a Zoom call. There was evidently a vote being taken via Zoom. And Cal, at about the 6-minute, 43-second mark, he can be seen shirtless, lying down with the Schoolhouse Rock, I'm Just a Bill background. I'm not quite sure why this is a story, other than this is our media, you know, not actually saying anything, other than, you know, a guy was probably, you know, in bed, you know, and up, oh, I got to go to work, and, you know, let me quick get the YouTube on here, or get the Zoom meeting up. They didn't talk about what the bill was. They didn't talk about how he voted. It was just that he was caught shirtless for a couple of seconds. And God, I don't care if he's a Republican or not. I don't get it. I don't get why it's a story. Sorry. It's one of those things that just, we're upset about nonsense. The fact that there are so many other issues out there, that this was a Fox News story that came into my feed, is insane to me. Now, look, if he had some kind of, you know, we're going to be banning, you know, shirtless people in public, and, you know, then I go, okay, it makes sense. I see the reason for the story, but there isn't any of that. And, you know, I was just telling my son the other day that, you know, when we were in gym class, you know, it was shirts versus skins. We didn't have cute little pinnies to put on so that we could be red team or blue team. You know, the fat kid always was on the skins team, and it made him feel bad. And we got over that. I don't get what has, I guess I'm struggling with this. Why this is a story? Why is this a story? So for my friends in Minneapolis, if you've got a reason why this is a story, I got to know. I got to know what Cal has done other than being seen for a moment shirtless. It's not like he was pantless. It was not like Cal's name was Carol and she was topless. That would be a story, but for I think much better reasons. I don't know. It's going to be an interesting week. There are lots of things going on this week that I... lots of organizing, lots of the potential writer's strike going to happen. We will be talking about all of that focusing a lot more on the Supreme Court's upcoming decision in this show to overturn the Chevron deference. There's a lot going on, a lot that's important, a lot that affects our day-to-day existence. And it's the kind of stuff that I think we should be organizing around to fix, as opposed to, well, organizing to destroy. As my grandfather always said, any idiot with a hammer can tear down a house. It takes a craftsman to build one. Let's be craftsmen. Let's take off the red hats and the blue hats and put on a hard hat and get to work, because we got a lot of it to do. If you miss any portion of the program, download the podcast. Wherever you get your podcasts, you will find ours. You got thoughts, questions, comments, something I said got under your skin, made you mad. I definitely want to hear that. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.